Hi, this is John Shuck, and today's topic is morality, specifically the new morality. My guest is Eden Collinsworth. She's the author of Behaving Badly, The New Morality in Politics, Sex, and Business.
The level of empathy decreases when there's a financial cost, and we're more likely to behave more altruistically, in a more gracious way, if it doesn't impact your own personal wealth or your income or your paycheck. And that's, I'm afraid that's human nature.
So how do we decide what is right and wrong? And how do people continue to draw moral lines even as things are complex and changing? Next on Progressive Spirit. Stay with us. Pacifica Radio Network, the Public Radio Exchange, PRX, and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit. ProgressiveSpirit.net. I'm John Shuck.
Many times now in the last year, certainly since the election, I've been on the subway in New York, and to my horror, you are hearing racial, there's confrontation and racial slurs, and New York people are always from some other place, so this is all fairly recent, and it's not just in America, New York, it's elsewhere, where you're standing cheek by jowl and you lash out at somebody who's wearing a headscarf or whatever, so this sign read, it was very simple, it was two words and a comma and two more words, and it was not them, only us. And what that did was not only galvanize people, but it held them to moral account. So they were going to get on that crowded subway and they were going to think twice about lashing out at somebody who was Muslim or, from some other place.
My guest is Eden Collinsworth. She's a former media executive and business consultant. She was formerly of Arbor House, a publishing company, founder of the LA-based monthly magazine Buzz. Before becoming a vice president at Hearst Corporation, she wrote a best-selling book in China for Chinese business people on Western deportment. And she launched Collinsworth & Associates, a Beijing-based consulting firm which specializes in intercultural communication. And she is in South Carolina. She's on the road talking about, in the United States, talking about her book. She lives in London, and she's with me via Skype. Welcome, Eden Collinsworth,
to
Progressive Spirit.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, you begin your book with a conversation about proper behavior with a story appropriately, I think, about your mother. So can you tell that story and how that story kind of illustrates the change generationally how we look at morality?
Yes. Well, I think, frankly, it's the other day somebody had suggested that their grandmother was rolling in their graves given the lack of moral direction. And I suggested to her that, in fact, it was probably a more recent generation as well. And my mother was European and a very old guard in her values. And so I think what is interesting to step back, I am now a parent of a young man. And it seems to me that in my generation, we were still, our moral sense was still very much influenced or instilled by our parents. And although I consider my son to be utterly decent, his morality has been not so much instilled by me as his parent, but shaped by these profound changes that have occurred during the course of his life, relatively short life. Still, they're very impactful changes. And so my mother felt that morality was very much a rule book, and some parts of that rule book were kind of enshrined as good behavior. Some parts were implicit. But, you know, it was very apparent when somebody behaved outside of those parameters, and that was considered to be bad and possibly immoral behavior. And now it seems to me that those borders are extremely porous. But she felt very strongly that, in fact, there was a right way and a wrong way of behaving. And to a large degree, my father did as well, although he came from a different background. He was a Southerner. He was a successful businessman. And he, regardless of what kind of business he was doing at any given time, he felt very strongly that his handshake was his bond. And that didn't prevent him from becoming successful. And I suspect that, you know, if he brought that same expectation to doing business these days, in fact, he would be at a distinct disadvantage. So, you know, it's certainly morality has changed, or the concept of morality or moral values have changed since my parents' time, and certainly from my grandparents' time. And I think that that's probably true with all of us.
And that is the quest of your book, Behaving Badly, The New Morality in Politics, Sex, and Business, is to describe this change. How did you decide to investigate morality, and to what ends of the earth did you go to discover the answer?
Yes, well, I took a very circuitous route. I mean, you were describing my background, and it sounds precisely what it is, which is extremely varied. And I was in my 20s, I was a book publisher in New York, and then I moved to LA in my 30s to launch a magazine. I came back to New York to become a corporate executive at the Hearst Corporation. I left for a period of time and spent, actually I commuted to Paris at one point because my son has gone through the French system, and I thought I'd give myself a break between having sold the magazine and doing whatever was next, but I had an offer I couldn't refuse. And so, and then I took a position very unexpectedly as the chief of staff of a global think tank, and that placed me in both in New York and in Brussels, but the offices were also in Moscow and Washington, and I did a tremendous amount of work in China. And I did that for 5 years. It was fascinating, but absolutely exhausting, because the Institute was focused on a remit that had to do with security issues. So it was weapons of mass destruction, cybersecurity, and so on and so forth, very serious issues. And, you know, I was about 72 hours ahead of the news cycle, which is fascinating, but absolutely exhausting. It was really relentless. And so I did that for 5 years, and I decided to leave that post and move to China to write a book about Western business practices specifically for the Chinese. And this was the result, actually, of going in and out of China over the period of the 30 years that, you know, I've just have kind of unspooled in terms of my career and in various capacities. And it seemed to me that there would be a real appetite for Chinese business people to better understand Western deportment, not because, frankly, they want to be more like the West, but because they saw it as a financial advantage to understand how to best interact with Western business people. And so because I had, you know, a history in book publishing, I was able to work very specifically with a Chinese a publisher. And in China, all of the media is state controlled, and most of it is state owned. And so I wrote this book in conjunction or in collaboration with a Chinese book publisher, and it was censored in the most bizarre way. It was very kind of Orwellian, because it wasn't anything in particular. It was just one word that the censor pulled up, and it was the word Muslim. But it was not in any provocative way that I referred to this, you know, that this word was employed. So I stayed in China slightly longer than I thought I would, and I became a consultant and did work in China. The book came out, and to my dismay, became an enormous bestseller. And this is a rather roundabout way of answering your question, but the point is that during the period of time that I lived in China, rather than kind of moving in and out of it on business, it became very apparent to me that my moral reference points were completely different. And I was working from, you know, a kind of a Judeo-Christian sense of fairness and right and wrong, black and white. And the Chinese have no, you know, what I would call homegrown religion. Buddhism was an import from India. They worship ancestors. And if they follow anything, it's more philosophical. You know, they're more philosophical beliefs, and so they are operate from a Confucian-based mentality or philosophy, and it was for me incredibly frustrating because you know, with something as direct as entering into a contractual agreement, in the West you believe that a contract is in fact the culmination of a dialogue, and then it reflects the agreement that you have come to. And with the Chinese, it really is kind of the continuation of the dialogue rather than codifying the terms. And so I started to think about that kind of very sobering, you know, fact that the Chinese, if you look at the world's population, are one in five people. And so here was this enormous nation with, you know, 1.3 billion people, and they simply weren't thinking like me in any sense of the word. And I started to then reflect on whether those what I call kind of the old guard sense of morality, whether that in fact was even applicable in my own country, that it seemed to me that it was becoming less and less germane in America. And so I thought that I would explore that. And that is how I came to the decision to write about it. I must say that I'm not an ethicist and I'm not a social scientist. I don't have advanced degrees in this field. And so for me, it was a personal exploration. And I very much hope that I take the reader along with me, because they're kind of fundamental issues, I think, that we all face.
If you're just joining us on Progressive Spirit, I'm speaking with Eden Collinsworth. She's the author of Behaving Badly, The New Morality in Politics, Sex, and Business, just talking about how this process of discovering what morality might be. You mentioned the Chinese philosophy of Confucianism. Well, that's certainly mm-hmm. traditional, too. And part of the I'm wondering if within China, if also morality is changing. But then you also said in your book that it's really highly censored on what the Chinese people get from the West.
Well, you know, it's not censored in the way that we think it is. You know, we as not surprisingly, all of us have a prejudice and believe what we want to believe. They are highly censored, but in a very specific way. So it's not necessarily, you know, the fear of getting information from outside of China. It is the concern that the internet will become a virtual meeting place from which to organize. And so, yes, it's frankly more censored now under President Xi than it was when I was there 5-6 years ago. That said, there, you know, what's really quite interesting is that some 30 years ago, when I first with my first trip to China, you know, I took the bullet train in from the airport. This was Shanghai. And so, you know, there I was being hurled ahead at, you know, over 300 miles an hour. And it frankly took just as long to slow the train down as it did the duration of the trip. And as the train was slowing down, I looked out the window, and what I saw was staggering. And it was peasants in a rice field, and many of them were on cell phones. And to me, that was the first indication that China was, in fact, moving ahead at this incredible pace. And what happened was they simply avoided any pitfalls when it came to cable in terms of the internet, and went immediately to satellite. And so they are very, very sophisticated in terms of their technological outreach. But, you know, they're also completely determined to some degree when it comes to most especially the Western values of civil liberties and a Western process of justice, that certainly is discouraged and yes, censored in a sense. However, that does not make them any less or more moral than Westerners. It makes them, you know, continue with a culture that, frankly, is thousands of years older than our own. And I think probably the most illustrious example of how they think, which is very different, is reflected in the written Chinese. And so I can't claim, you know, to speak or write Chinese. My son, however, does. And he was telling me at one point he had to learn, you know, the old Mandarin, which is slightly more elaborate. And in the old Mandarin, the character for the word black in it has a sub-character for the word white, the color white. And so they operate very comfortably and literally in the gray area, whereas I, as a Westerner, most especially with my background, I am very results-oriented. I like everything orderly. And, you know, I think that there's a very definite white and black in terms of right and wrong. They feel that there are many ways of being right and, quite honestly, not many ways of being wrong.
You mentioned more and less moral. What, maybe just some definitions, and maybe that's the whole point of the book. But what is morality, and what does it mean to be moral, and how do you define it? Is should we be, and is there even such a thing as should?
Well, I mean, you know, quite honestly, I thought that before I started to write the book, the logical place to start would be with the definition of the word. And so the definition of morals, which is, you know, is comes from the Latin mores, is fundamentally what you expect of yourself. In other words, it's a set of personal beliefs. And ethics is different. And we sometimes mix the two words up. Ethics has to do with what your society, your particular society at a given time defines as a certain level of behavior, what's expected of you. And also there are sanctions and there are rewards and there are punishments if you operate outside of those, that parameter. So many times, you know, ethics and morality comes into a direct conflict, so to speak. So, you know, ethically speaking, a lawyer in America, at any rate, is obliged to defend his or her client to the best of his or her ability, despite the fact or regardless of whether that person has offends the moral values of the lawyer. So, and this is the what makes it confusing, frankly, for people. You know, my age, who have grown up with a very distinct set of what is believed to be right and wrong, that the subtlety occurs in the definition in a period of time within a society. So here we are in the history of the world, we have never been so connected, so interconnected, and yet the fact remains that people operate within their cultural silos at a given time. So that is why you're just kind of staggered that, you know, here we are, you know, in 2017, and people belonging to a certain culture elsewhere, even in your own country, frankly. I mean, we've never been so polarized. They simply are operating with a different set of ethical values. And so it gets even more baffling in terms of human behavior. But I think, you know, people behave the way people behave. And what what calls them into account is what the society expects of that person. And then, you know, more internally, it's what you expect of yourself. And I always think of it as, you know, morality is you telling yourself, well, I shouldn't do this, even though it could be legal or acceptable. You know, in a larger scheme of thing, it's you setting your own parameters.
Yeah, you talked about it's kind of that morality is that in between part where there's something that could be done, and but I can't cross that line. And somewhere in there is that individual sense of moral direction or moral compass.
Yes, that's true. But, you know, a very interesting example of that, what I did was I approached the subject kind of thematically. So, and that obviously is evidenced by the subtitle, where I concentrated on politics, sex and business primarily. But under those categories, there were various chapters, and I deliberately chose somebody to interview for each chapter who was kind of an unexpected example of the issue. So what was really interesting for me was the interview I had with a British CEO of an enormous, possibly one of the largest, certainly Japanese companies. This was Olympus, one of the major international corporations. And he worked his way up through the ranks. So very unusual that the Japanese actually then assigned the role of CEO to an outsider. But in fact, it was important to the board because they felt that a change of direction had to occur within the corporation. And it's always easier for somebody not Japanese, in fact, to implement that change and see it through. So this gentleman who was at this corporation for some 30 years, he wasn't unfamiliar with it. It was, you know, what he did without a break or any other job for the better part of his career. So as soon as he became the CEO, he was then asked for certain financials. He realized to his complete shock that there was, that a multi-million dollar fraudulent, entry had simply been passed from one CEO to the next. He had gone through three CEOs, and this was never addressed, much less corrected. And the point is that as long as it wasn't addressed, it wouldn't have an impact on the bottom line. And so it was this kind of, secondary reality that continued to move forward. And he brought it to the board, and the chairman fired him. So, and here he had done the right thing. He did the responsible thing. But what he then also did was to insist that, the chairman step down. So how he handled it was not entirely worldly, because frankly, from the Japanese perspective, the immorality was then disabling the company, because as a result of bringing this to the forefront, they had to declare the loss. And as a result of the loss, people lost their jobs, because they had to cut back. They had to find savings, and so they did it by letting people go. So he was vilified, for in fact being disloyal to the company. And that is very specific to that culture. So, there you have a perfect example of how he thought he was doing the right thing in the Western sense. And they thought that, in fact, he was doing very much the wrong thing and the immoral thing, certainly the irresponsible thing, by forcing an issue that then would require the firing of people. He was not loyal to the company. And so that they felt that in fact, was an act of immorality. So, it's everything is relative.
Everything is relative. You quote Oscar Wilde at some point that morality is what is it that other that you find distasteful, right? That another person's morality is something.
Well, we fall back on our own personalities, and uh-huh. And he was a wonderful wordsmith. And he simply said that morality is the dislike you have for people you don't agree with. And that's probably to a degree true. But with this particular example, it had very far-reaching consequences.
Absolutely. And it also is a sense in which morality, as we think about it, is also rather unconscious. And it also refers to how we make a living.
Yes.
It's in our interest that we often don't know.
I think that's absolutely true. I think that, you know, if you look at the seven deadly sins, which is a kind of blueprint of really bad behavior, and one of them is greed, of course. And quite honestly, if you think of it in a literal sense, and you see what's transpired, most especially in the last 30 years, you know, greed, many people believe that greed is the engine for capitalism, because you know, it's all about increasing the profit margin. The one thing that it became, as I moved my way across the, you know, it didn't matter where I was, whether I was in China, you know, in France, in the US, it just seems to me that people around money, you're usually disappointed in terms of how they behave around money. And you can think back to your family members, your friends. You can look at the Panama Papers, which, you know, it wasn't illegal, but certainly it was immoral. They were outwitting. They were trying to outwit, the tax system. And if you looked at the people involved, it was like the United Nations. I mean, there was, you know, somebody from Greenland. It was, you know, there was the members of President Xi's family in China. There were countless Americans. There were, you know, British. And so I looked into some research, the empirical information, if you look at, you know, how people behave around money. And there's no doubt that the level of empathy decreases when there's a financial cost, and we're more likely to behave, more altruistically in a more gracious way if it doesn't impact your own personal, wealth or your income or your paycheck, and that's, I'm afraid, that's human nature.
My guest on Progressive Spirit is Eden Collinsworth. She's the author of Behaving Badly, The New Morality in Politics, Sex, and Business. I'm John Schack. Stay with us. We continue the conversation after the break. Behaving Badly, The New Morality in Politics, Sex, and Business is the book we're discussing. The author is Eden Collinsworth, and she's talking with me via Skype. This is Progressive Spirit. Two questions. One, what impact, what just kind of put you in a tailspin most of your stories, if that could be the right word, of your morality? What challenged a bit of that? That one. And then was there a story in there that you found also, well, rather inspiring about the human condition?
Well, I must tell you that the most difficult chapter for me and the most compelling chapter, which speaks on both of those points, was an interview I had with a man who had murdered two people.
Yeah.
And just to frame this in perspective, in the UK, unlike America, after you serve your sentence for whatever crime, their philosophy and their attitude is that you start afresh. You have the opportunity, you've paid your dues, and you have the opportunity to start anew. Also, it's extremely difficult to find out the specifics of why somebody is in prison, what specifically transpired. And so What happened in this regard, in terms of my own exploration, is that I sent emails out to various people, some people I knew, some people I didn't, because I wanted to speak to somebody. The crime didn't matter, but I wanted to speak to somebody who obviously had done something so undeniably wrong and in my mind, immoral. One person then sent me to another, and eventually I had a correspondence with this man who did not give me his birth name, and I had no idea. I understood that he had murdered two people, but I had no idea of the circumstances. And this was my prejudice. This was fascinating, to better understand myself. I had to look back and see that initially I thought, because he expressed himself a certain way, he was very dignified and about it and quite articulate. He didn't go into any details, but just by the tenure of his communication with me, I thought that he had to be. It had to have been a murder of passion, that he came home, he found his wife with a lover or, whatever, and then he killed them both. Because I couldn't imagine anybody who was this eloquent and actually reserved in his correspondence was, somebody who murdered a different way. In other words, I had it in my mind that he murdered a certain way for a certain reason. Well, in fact, it was completely the opposite. I didn't know this until, in fact, the day before he arrived at my flat, by the way, and I was the only one there. I needed to record the discussion, and I needed a quiet place, a private quiet place. And so I had invited other people to my flat, and I thought, well, there's no reason why it was my moral obligation to extend the benefit of the doubt and goodwill. And so there was no reason for me to try to think of another place to interview him. At any rate, this was a man who had absolutely no, his was such a brutal childhood. And he immediately made clear to me that this didn't justify the murders. He murdered for money. He burglarized and one person came home, and he had an accomplice, and they were caught off guard, and they killed this man, and another person, they killed in a park. It was basically for money. And he made it very clear that nothing justified what he had done, but his decisions thereafter made him a moral agent in a way that I couldn't have imagined. And what happened, to make his story as short as possible, he, without taking away from it, he went through the court. He ran off when he was 8 years old. His mother was killed. His father was a violent drunk who beat him. He ran off at eight, and he began to steal at eight, and that's all he knew. And not surprisingly, he then, as he got older, he then, became slightly more sophisticated about how he stole, and he began to burglarize apartments. Never, as a result of these two deaths, did anyone suspect it was this man. He was, kind of off the grid. And so, he was not pinned to either of these murders. He did escape. He decided to leave the country, and he went to France, and he joined the Foreign Legion, which is when you can absolutely disappear. You get a new, if you so wish, a new identity. And the point that is important to acknowledge here is that during the course of his 4 or 5 years in the Foreign Legion, he became a great leader of men. He was put in charge. He was sent to the Congo. He was, enormously respected. And his point to me was that was the opportunity, that was the first opportunity he had of actually moving into a schedule, being responsible, accepting a code of conduct, which was, honorable, becoming moral. In other words, he felt that it was the first time he had the mechanics were in place to allow him an understanding of what he had done. And in a way that was staggering to me, he decided to give himself up, even though he wasn't identified as the murderer of either of these two men. And he gave himself up in France, and he was brought back to the UK. He stood trial. He was given a 23-year sentence, the first of which was in solitary confinement. He read his way through the only thing he was given only for that 1 year, just an hour out of his cell a day. But he was allowed to take out 6 books a week to read. And keep in mind, this is somebody who never had an education. He ran off when he was 8. He was never in school. Obviously, he was very, you know, certainly in terms of a language, he was quick enough to have picked up French, you know, when he arrived to join the Foreign Legion. But, you know, this man had absolutely nothing. He was given up on. He was not educated. It was just hopeless. And again, that doesn't justify the murders, but he somehow found his way out of just a point of no return by making this moral decision. And that was extremely difficult for me to reconcile, that this man who had done these absolutely unspeakable, merciless, murders, that then could actually become a moral person who made the decision first to give himself up, knowing the consequences, and then actually then to become, you know, to come to the realization that the only thing he could do was to be the best he could be once he got out. And so he is now, you know, speaking at schools. He told me that to repeat his story allows him to actually live with it. And he's a trustee on various prison reform, committees in the UK. So, you know, for me, that was the most difficult. It was actually the most dispiriting, but at the same time, it was the most inspiring.
Eden Collinsworth, my guest. She's the author of Behaving Badly, The New Morality in Politics, Sex, and Business. I'm, as you tell a story, I think you use the word in the book of redemption
yes.
And in a sense, so that kind of has talks about religion. I mean, in the old days, that's what religion was supposed to do, right? Discipline us to be moral.
I think what's happened is that the church, I mean, again, this is what this is my personal perspective, but it's the result of having traveled in and living outside of my country and traveling and then researching, this book. The church, it's generational. So, you know, to loop back to my son, who's now in his late 20s, he actually, even the generation under him, they are a generation that, even if they might be spiritual and they might even be religious, but they think of morality in a very broad sense. So their moral reference points are not necessarily coming from one particular source. So they look at, social media, and they might think of their own spirituality. They're not necessarily moved by institutional morality. So, the church is in a kind of constant catch-up. And I'm talking about, the church as organized religion. And what was interesting for me was during the course of the year that it took me to write the book, Ireland, which is a predominantly Catholic country, was the first country to legalize gay marriage. And it absolutely stunned people, including the church. But, I looked into who pushed this movement forward, and they were predominantly Catholic. They were not in the church. Well, some of them were. But it's the same if you think of my generation or older, might question the morality of Edward Snowden. If you talk to anybody under a certain age, they think, in fact, he made the moral choice. It was a courageous and moral choice that he made. A great deal of this has to do with, it's generational. And And so things have changed. It's that simple. It's not that they, it's a less of a morality. It's a different morality. And they feel that it's, they're far more flexible than I am, frankly.
I'm talking with Eden Collinsworth, author of Behaving Badly, The New Morality in Politics, Sex and Business. I do want to talk about sex for a minute. Same-sex couples having children. And you related a couple of stories regarding that and how that is a challenge between generations. I know within my own family and the ethics regarding that. Can you talk just a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, you know, again, this is a reminder of how quickly changes have occurred in the last 20 years. If you look at the issue of fertility, now there are so many more options. Some of them are kind of unbelievable in terms of the options one has now to reproduce. What I was interested in was the idea of not only gay marriage, but more to the point, how forming a family has changed. And right. And what that constitutes. And so, again, if you look at young people in their 20s, how a family is formed, you know, whether somebody is, you know, has been biologically altered in some way, it's, you know, you've got a donor, you know, all of that is slightly academic as opposed to their parents' generation, where, you know, there was a kind of prototype in terms of how you form a family. And, it's just extremely different. That said, I don't think that they are less good parents or less moral parents. I mean, if you have a gay family where, you know, they've either adopted or most to the point now that you can orchestrate it where, in fact, you are the biological parent of your own child. I think that what has to be remembered is that it just makes it different. It doesn't make it bad or good. It makes it extremely different from people who have grown up with a certain set of parameters. And what was interesting to me was a reminder that the word bastard, you know, in my lifetime was considered to be for the obvious reason, considered to be demeaning. And in fact, if you ask somebody today of a certain age, the literal sense of that word has been lost. I don't think that's so bad, by the way.
No, I don't. You mentioned something, the orchestration of birth. I mean, and that really is, that's what I was getting at, is that it's really new territory that, for example, same-sex couples have to create on their own and find their own ethics and how they're going to do that. And it's complex. And
it also depends upon the legality of where you are. And so what happens, and this is a genuine concern, and I appreciate it, is that the people who can afford it, because in fact, it can become extremely expensive and your insurance isn't covering it. You can kind of pick and choose your, you know, they call it you design your reproductive opportunities by, you know, just kind of cherry picking your way through what's available and legal. So, for example, in the UK, it is illegal to manipulate in order to choose one gender over the other. It isn't in America, and so wealthy people who in the UK come to the US to increase the chances or guarantee the chances you have one sex or the other. And so it's relative to where you are and the legalities and most to the point what you can afford. So it's illegal to freeze your eggs if you're a woman in China, but the people who can afford it come to California and take care of that there. There are a lot of options, some of which you need a kind of flow chart to follow. I mean, I remember in LA years ago, I was taken back to say the least. I knew a couple for 10 years. I knew them, both of them individually and as a married couple. I consider them completely, utterly unquestionably moral and committed to their marriage, but in a very casual way, you know, it became the woman told me that her husband, again, both of these were very dear friends, was making himself available to a lesbian couple they knew, both of whom wanted to get pregnant. There was the understanding that whoever got pregnant first, obviously, then, you know, the other one would kind of step aside for a period of time. And this man who I knew, again, utterly committed to the marriage, was making himself available. And I thought, well, I'm not quite sure how I would feel about that. How would I feel if my husband agreed to inseminate, where there was a child? And so it's very personal. And then to make matters even more complicated, you know, when I was a year or so later, when I was in LA, this was, you know, LA is always kind of one musical step ahead of, I think, ahead of the rest of, of America, anyway, in terms of the trend line. But I was made aware of, I went off to a lunch with a group of people, and it happened that there was a woman who, you know, she was a lesbian. Her brother was gay. They were both in relationships. And so the understanding was her brother would inseminate her lover, and she would then be inseminated by his lover or partner. And then they would somehow swap babies. And it was so beyond me. And I thought, well, that's where I got really uncomfortable. I thought, well, it was one thing for somebody to father a child, you know, it was another thing then to swap babies. So, I mean, it's all relative. I didn't understand where I was supposed to draw the line. It was very, for me, very, there was something that was coming from the base of my spine that told me, well, this, I don't mind about this, but this, I really have got to think twice about.
Huh. Yeah. And then you said, but you also believed that those couples would raise those children, whichever one happened, with great love and everything.
Unquestionably. And I mean, you know, I'm fairly, my facial expression apparently is very demonstrative. So even though I'm keeping my thoughts to myself, I gather, you know, what I was expressing on my face was, you know, complete confusion. And of course, the woman who was explaining this, she, I suppose, for all the obvious reasons, she became rather defensive. And she said, do you have a problem with this? And I said, I'm not sure whether I've got a problem. And she said, well, it doesn't matter if you have a problem. What you have to understand and accept is that these babies, no matter how they're brought up or with whom, they will be loved unquestionably. And I absolutely believe that perhaps that's the most important thing.
Well, that's the challenge. What is the most important thing? How do we decide in the end? And a lot of it just is outcome, I guess, as the behavior
is. Well, I mean, I must say the challenge and the inspiration, and it will become more and more of a challenge. Mm-hmm. The fact is that regardless of what politicians promise, and it's not just in this country, I've seen it in Europe, in now in the UK, I've seen it now, it's very much a global, you know, issue. There is a churn of humanity that will not diminish. That is our world now. And so if you take, for example, the mayor of London, the current mayor of London, he is the son of a Pakistani London bus driver. He was asked to explain himself or describe himself. I was just staggered by the simplicity of it. So he explained that he was a Londoner, that he was a European, that he was British, that he was English, that he was of Islamic faith, he was of Asian origin, and he was of Pakistani heritage, and he was a father, and he was a husband. He was all of those things, genuinely speaking. I mean, he had all of those threads connecting to, and that is more and more, that will be the world. You cannot somehow think that that's not happening, and you cannot keep that in one place. 2 or 3 weeks ago, there was this horrific attack terrorist attack on the Westminster Bridge, and, you know, the Londoners were not they were not surprised because, you know, we've all seen what's happened in Europe and they're far more deadly attacks, but they were shocked. And and of course it's shocking. It's so haphazard and awful and shocking. And it happened just before 3 o'clock. And by 5:30, which is the beginning of their rush hour, the Arts Fund put up immediately, they went to the largest, the busiest tube stations, and above the turnstiles, they put up an enormous sign that you couldn't help but see, regardless. I mean, everyone was trying to get home. It was a very upsetting day. And I must say, many times now in the last year, certainly since the election, I've been on the subway in New York, and to my horror, you are hearing racial, you know, there's confrontation and racial slurs. And, you know, New York people are always from some other place. So this is all fairly recent. And it's not just in America, New York, it's elsewhere where you're standing cheek by jowl and you lash out at somebody who's wearing a headscarf or whatever. And so this sign read, it was very simple. It was two words and a comma and two more words. And it was "not them, only us." And what that did was not only galvanize people, but it held them to moral account. So they were going to get on that crowded subway and they were going to think twice about lashing out at somebody who was Muslim or, you know, from some other place. And I think that's probably what we need to do with each other, is to hold ourselves and other people to account.
Yes, I think that there's a sense in which perhaps morality may be emergent in all of our interactions, that we may surprise ourselves, who knows, negatively or positively, but I'm hoping positively that a new morality may emerge that even binds us to the metaphor I can use, a standard behavior.
Yes, well, I agree with you, and that is... that's my hope. After a year of having searched for modern morality, that is certainly my hope.
Eden Collinsworth, thank you so much for being with me. A very important, thoughtful and thought-inspiring book, Behaving Badly, The New Morality in Politics, Sex, and Business. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I very much appreciate it.
Progressive Spirit is heard every week on several radio stations across the country. 60 Minutes of Smart. Progressive Spirit is now in its 6th year and is now an hour long. On Progressive Spirit, you hear interviews with cutting-edge scholars, authors, and activists who have something to say about social justice, human flourishing, and things that matter. If you enjoy the show, ask your local public radio station to check it out and consider adding Progressive Spirit to its weekly lineup. Progressive Spirit is formatted for radio and is distributed through Public Radio Exchange, PRX, and the Pacifica Radio Network. You can also catch Progressive Spirit on podcast. Hear it on your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear and listen on iTunes or Stitcher or any app that has a place for a review, please leave one. More reviews help the show get a wider audience. If you have ideas for guests or would like to comment on an episode, contact me through my website, progressivespirit.net. You can comment on Facebook and retweet on Twitter. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon. I'm John Schack. Be well.